turn back now to the fourth chapter, wherein, of course, we find the continuing story of the vision, the last one given to Nebuchadnezzar. As I said before, in reality, of course, this chapter should be called the Book of Nebuchadnezzar, even though it would be but one chapter long. Of course, it would not be the only one chapter book in the Bible, as the second and third epistles of John are likewise one chapter in length. Now, you'll notice, even though in Daniel chapter 2, the magicians have been shown to have no capacity to explain visions and dreams, such as were given to King Nebuchadnezzar by God himself, despite the fact that in Daniel chapter 3, we have the story of the triumph of God's power in the great battle fought by King Nebuchadnezzar against the church of God at that time, we still find that King Nebuchadnezzar, in his hour of need, turns back to Babylon as the answer to that need. Now, this obviously was another reversion. Very ugly word, that. Last year, of course, we saw how in the experience of Joshua, for instance, there were quite a number of unfortunate reversions back to human planning once again. And each one, of course, was tended by a very disappointing result. But fortunately for Joshua, the lesson was learned, and after each mistake, he turned back to the right way once more. But you know, we human beings who can never see beneath the surface are so apt to become discouraged at the slow progress made by a soul who is the subject of our patient, shall I say, or maybe not so patient ministry. Now, of course, if you have been involved, as Daniel was, in the salvation of King Nebuchadnezzar, at the very beginning, you look upon that man as being anything but a promising candidate for the kingdom. When we go out day by day and we have this message in our hearts and we have a natural desire, of course, to see other souls won to the message, don't you find yourself tending, as you meet a person, to evaluate the prospects of that particular person taking up the message? Don't you? I find myself doing that. I try to assess the response I may get if I talk to that person about the gospel. And I have to admit that, generally speaking, I don't see much possibility in this person and that person taking up the message. And I found sometimes that the people I least expected to take the message have taken it very strongly, and the ones I had best hoped for turned the thing down completely. Had this experience. Now, coming back to Nebuchadnezzar, as Daniel looked upon that man who was called the terrible of the nations, a man whose hands had been dipped in blood as he climbed to the throne of power, a man who was the very head of the Babylonian system, a man whose very thinking had been molded by the Babylonian priesthood, would not Daniel be excused or understood, at least if he regarded that particular king as being a very doubtful prospect for the message? Most certainly. Well, Daniel, of course, was impressed by God's outreach for this king, as God brought to Nebuchadnezzar that wonderful dream of Daniel chapter 2. God didn't have to do that. God could just as well have given Daniel that particular dream and not give it to Nebuchadnezzar at all. As a matter of fact, let's think about this for a moment. How many dreams or visions more did God give to Daniel than to Nebuchadnezzar? None. They had two each. King Nebuchadnezzar had a vision in Daniel 2. Not Daniel, but the king had that vision. And who had this vision in Daniel chapter 4? Nebuchadnezzar. There's two for Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Daniel only had two prophetic visions in his whole lifetime. They're found in Daniel 7 and Daniel chapter 8. Now, there was another vision in Daniel chapter 10, which was a revelation of Jesus Christ. But in Daniel 9 and 11 and 12, Daniel was given explanation of visions. He was not given actual visions in those preceding chapters. So when it comes to prophetic visions, King Nebuchadnezzar had as many as Daniel did. Is that surprising? We tend to think that Daniel had vision after vision after vision, don't we? But he didn't. He had one toward the end. They had one in the first year of King Belshazzar, after Nebuchadnezzar's death, and yet another one in the third year of King Belshazzar, recorded in the 8th chapter of the book of Daniel, and after that he had no more at all. So in a lifetime that span something like possibly 90 years, because Daniel must have been at least 20 when he went to Babylon as a captive, and 70 years later, when Babylon fell, he was still very, very much alive. So in 90 years of life, Daniel had only two prophetic visions, which wasn't very much altogether. Well, when God came to Nebuchadnezzar, come back to our main thought again, when God came to Nebuchadnezzar in great love, gave him the vision of the image, and through Daniel's explanation thereof, well, very certainly, of course, this made a very tremendous impression upon King Nebuchadnezzar. But only a very short time goes by when the king completely reverts from and rejects the position he took in response to those revelations. Sets up a great golden image and a burning fiery furnace, and threatens anyone in the world who doesn't worship the golden image to be cast alive into the burning fiery furnace. Now, if you've been waiting for King Nebuchadnezzar as a soul winner, and been encouraged by seeing him take the stand he did after the victory of Daniel chapter 2, and then saw him turn around to take those extreme steps, those utterly Babylonian steps, what would you tend to do in your mind so far as he's concerned? Write him off. Hopeless case. Not worth waiting for. And mind you, of course, the witness of Daniel and his three companions to King Nebuchadnezzar was not confined to these great crises. When when King Nebuchadnezzar looked into the burning fiery furnace and said the form of the fourth is like unto the Son of God, Scripture White tells us that he was able to recognize the fourth person as the Son of God because of the witness that had been given by these four young men as they lived and worked in the king's presence from day to day. You can find the statement quickly here in Prophets and Kings. It should be on page 509, but it doesn't seem to be there. But yes, it does. How did the heathen king know what the Son of God was like? The Hebrew captives, filling positions of trust in Babylon, had in life and character represented before him the truth. When asked for a reason for their faith, they had given it without hesitation. Plainly and simply, they had presented the principles of righteousness, thus teaching those around them of the God whom they worshipped. They had told of Christ, the Redeemer, to come, and the form of the fourth in the midst of the fire, the king recognized the Son of God. Now, as I said a moment ago, when the king made his fearful reversion, of course, naturally, the four young men would tend to regard him as being a hopeless case. But the wonderful thing is that deep down below, where to our eyes everything seemed to be sterile and barren and dead, God saw that in that king there is still the possibility of a response. As we said before in our previous study period, King Nebuchadnezzar came to a point of great personal danger when all his battles won, the city built, he could sit back and enjoy the pleasures and luxuries he gathered around about himself. And this course of action was building up a sense of great self-sufficiency, an enormous sense of pride, and most certainly a very decided separation from the God of heaven, which could and did result in a complete mental breakdown for him when the strain became too great for him to endure. Now here is the God of heaven who doesn't say, well, Nebuchadnezzar, you've had two wonderful opportunities. After all, I came to you and personally planned to reach you through the miracle of the vision and the interpretation of the image. And there at the golden image I demonstrated before you through Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego the power and the truth of my message. And after all that, now you turn back to the world, well, look, I'm not going to worry about you any further. But you know, my heart is touched as I realize that God didn't take that attitude. That whatever there was in King Nebuchadnezzar, some possibility, some response, some willingness to listen to God's voice, God would reach out the hand to save that king from disaster and from destruction. God is a savior, and a savior only, as we learnt in the study of his great and wonderful character. And here in the story of Nebuchadnezzar, the Antichrist of that time, the one who is most devoted to war against God's kingdom, we find that the love of God was manifested in a very remarkable and touching and wonderful way. And even when King Nebuchadnezzar called in the magicians and the astrologers instead of Daniel, God waited until Nebuchadnezzar called upon God through Daniel. Now, interestingly enough, of course, those Chaldeans previously had said, well, show us the dream, we will tell the interpretation. Now we find that they were told the dream, but even then they could not tell the interpretation of the dream. And they could not do so, even though Sister White says that the dream was very straightforward, I think is the word that she uses in this particular connection. From page 516, it says that although the dream was very explicit, none of the wise men could interpret it. It was a very explicit dream. There is no great profound mystery about this presentation. Now, it could have been, of course, that the Chaldeans, it simply says, they did not make known to me the interpretation. There may have been, of course, a certain reluctance on their part because they could plainly see, maybe they could see, that the dream was a harbinger of trouble and distress and disaster for the king of Babylon. And they were afraid to tell him what they knew he would not want to hear. Now we come to verse 8 in chapter 4, and we read these words. But at the last Daniel came in before me, his name was Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy God, and before him I told the dream the same. And now we have the dream outlined before us. So let's read straight to the verse 18 to get the picture quite clear in mind. O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee, and no secret troubleth thee, tell me the visions of my head, of my dreams that I have seen, and the interpretation thereof. Thus were the visions of mine head in my bed. I saw and behold a tree in the midst of the earth, and the height thereof was great. The tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto the heavens, and the sight thereof to the end of the earth. The leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all. The beast of the field had shadow under it, and the fowls of the heaven dwelt in the boughs thereof, and all flesh was fed of it. I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher and a holy one came down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, hew down the tree, and cut off his branches, take off his leaves, and scatter his fruit, that the beast get away from under it, and the fowls from his branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump of his roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, and attend the grass of the field, and that it be wet with the dew of heaven, and that his portion be with the beast in the grass of the earth. That his heart be changed from man's, and that a beast's heart be given unto him, and the seven times pass over him. This matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now thou, O Belteshazzar, declare the interpretation thereof, forasmuch as all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known unto me the interpretation, but thou art able, for the spirit of the holy God is in thee. And Nebuchadnezzar, of course, had learnt this much by this time, that Daniel never failed him. And therefore, in reality, the God of heaven never failed him. So he could confidently say that the spirit of the holy God is in thee, and you can do it. So Daniel is faced now once more with this challenge or this commission to bring home to the mind of the king the truth about this great dream. Let's just very quickly place the points of the dream here on the board tonight. Here we find that growing out in the fields of this world is this very, very great and wonderful tree of rather enormous proportions that is growing there and giving sustenance to all the animals and beasts and so forth of the earth. The birds found lodging in it, and there was a tree which was a great provider to all the needs and wants of the people in the earth back at that time. But then there came a time when the tree was cut down, and all that was left in the ground was a stump, very short and close to the earth, but there it was, cut off as neatly as can be, and possessing a band of iron and a band of brass. And for 7 years, or seven times I should more accurately say, were allowed to pass over this great stump before there was any possibility of it coming back to its own again. So there was the vision, as it was given by God to King Nebuchadnezzar and relayed by the king to Daniel, who was then called upon to make known the interpretation of it. Now, when Daniel heard what the dream was, he instantly recognized it was bad news for the king. So we read down in verse 19, "Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. The king spake and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee. Belteshazzar answered and said, My lord, the dream be to them that hate thee, and the interpretation thereof to thine enemies." And now begins the interpretation. I want you to notice that this prophecy was conditional. Its fulfillment depended upon whether the king hearkened to the warning or did not hearken to the warning which was given to him. So we read on, "The tree that thou sawest, which grew and was strong, whose height reached unto the heaven, and the sight thereof to the earth, whose leaves were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and upon whose branches the fowls of the heaven had their habitation. It is thou, O king, that art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown, and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion to the end of the earth. And whereas the king saw a watcher and holy one coming down from heaven and saying, Hew the tree down and destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass, attend the grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field till 7 times pass over him." This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. They shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and 7 times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree root, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee, after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility. What a wonderful manifestation of God's love to give that king that kind of warning. It's a very remarkable testimony of the outreach of God's saving power to that great and heathen king that lived back at that point of time. So I would have to say, I think, that God would do this far more than he has been able to do it if only God had, in every age and generation, men and women as faithful as Daniel and his three friends were. God could make many plans that he never is able to make and put into execution because he just simply can't find the workman to carry out the plan for him. As we read the other day, that divine power without human cooperation can accomplish virtually nothing, just as human power without divine aid can likewise accomplish absolutely nothing. Now, 12 months later, the warning of what would come became no longer a prophecy but actual history. And the king was walking at the end of that time on the roof of his palace and looking out at the glorious kingdom which he built. Let's read these verses down, 28, 29, 30. All this came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar. The end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. And the king spake and said, Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom of my, by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? While the words of the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, thy kingdom is departed from thee, and they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. The same hour was the thing fulfilled unto Nebuchadnezzar. And in this chapter, there are a number of verses which we need to examine rather carefully, because they seem to indicate that God is very much an arbitrary manipulator of the affairs of men down here upon this earth. Let's look at those verses now to see what they have to say. The first one back in verse 17, I believe, where it says, this decree is by the decree of the watchers. Now, this matter is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the basis of men. Now, interestingly enough, Nebuchadnezzar said those words because they had been conveyed to him in the vision. He was repeating, of course, a message which God had given to him in the dream of the great tree. Now these words are repeated again in verse 25. Let's take the last two or three lines of the verse where it says, and seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And the same idea is repeated the third time in verse 32. Where it says, and seven times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. So three times that idea is repeated in this particular chapter. Now when in a chapter the same truth is repeated three times, then what is God trying to do? To emphasize it, to make absolutely certain we don't miss that particular point. Now the question must now arise, in what sense does God appoint or give the kingdoms of men to rulers who are described here as being the basis of men? Now give me some names which you can very easily do of rulers who can be described in that category of being the basis of men. Pardon? Most presidents. I think there's some outstanding ones there, such as Adolf Hitler, Nero, that monster in Rome. Those are two men that stand out as being the very basis of men. Of course, there are other men like Idi Amin, who ruled in Uganda at the time, and his rule was one of unabated terror and oppression of the people under his command. He was the very worst kind of ruler, a butcher, to say the very least of him. Now, the natural interpretation, the immediate interpretation which people will tend to get from this verse, is that God says, all right, now I'm going to select the men who rule in this particular country. So I'll put Hitler over Germany during those particular years. I'll appoint Nero to rule back there in ancient Rome at that period of time. I'll put Idi Amin over here in Uganda for that period of time. Now, if the God of heaven was arbitrarily to select those kinds of men to be rulers in those kinds of countries, then what a fearful indictment that would be of God's character. Now, if you have that kind of power, or rather, if we believe that God has that kind of power, exercise that kind of arbitrary power, and at the same time God is the God of love, then what kind of men would you suppose God would select to be rulers over nations? Good men or bad men? Good men. And furthermore, if the God of heaven was to make arbitrary choices like that and was actually manipulating the nations of this world to that extent, then God must be responsible for all the evil things done by evil men right down to the ages. And God is responsible too for sin going on for so long, because he could very easily have arranged it so that the work of God could be finished very, very quickly if he was going to arbitrarily manipulate the affairs of men. How then should we understand this question, which of course has a very, very vital bearing on the character of God? Now, let's turn to Romans. Turn away from the book of Daniel for a moment and turn to the book of Romans to read an illustration of this and the experience of Sarah of old. Romans chapter 9, and we'll start with verse 14, where Paul asks the question, what shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? God forbid. Now keep that thought in mind, and we're going to ask you the question too, is there unrighteousness with God? And what must be the answer? No. God forbid. There is no unrighteousness with God. Now, Paul now chooses an example in the Old Testament which seems to deny his argument rather than support it. But it becomes very obvious, of course, if we read about Pharaoh of old in the land of Egypt, and from that we draw the conclusion there is unrighteousness with God, then we have obviously failed to understand the argument which Paul is advancing. We come to verse 15, Romans chapter 9. For he saith to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. And does that sound like playing favorites? It sounds like that. Let's read on. So then, it is not of him that willeth, nor of him that runneth, but of God that showeth mercy. For the Scripture saith unto Pharaoh, even for this same purpose have I raised thee up, that I might show my power in thee, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth. Therefore, hath he mercy on whom he will have mercy, and whom he will he hardeneth. Pharaoh saith unto me, why doth he yet find fault? For who hath resisted his will? Nay, but, O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honour and another unto dishonour? What if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction, and that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy, which he has afore prepared unto glory, even us, whom he has called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. Now then, Paul says there's no unrighteousness with God, but as you read those verses, it doesn't appear that there is injustice, arbitrary selectivity, and therefore favoritism, and therefore unrighteousness on the part of God. Don't those verses seem to say just that? Don't they? They sure do. Let's go back there now and examine them rather more carefully to see just what the real story in this particular case is. Verse 17. For the Scripture said unto Pharaoh, even for this same purpose have I raised thee up, that I might show my power in thee, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth. Let's go back now and see in what sense it was that God raised up a Pharaoh who was particularly hard, resistant, stubborn, and obstinate. Very good. Come back now and look at the life of Moses. Where were the first 40 years of Moses' life spent? Where? In the court of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Now, as we know, Moses was the heir to the throne. So at the end of 40 years, he fled away to the next phase of his life, namely the next 40 years, which were spent in the land of Midian. Right? So here now we have the next 40 years of time, and after that he came back for the second time to the throne of Egypt and addressed himself to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, at that point of time. Now, in the meantime, while he was away there in Midian, what happened to the Pharaoh who ruled while he was in Egypt? He died. Very good. Now then, who then took the throne of Egypt upon the death of the old Pharaoh? Who took that throne but the second in line to that position of power? Now, where was that second in line to the position of power? during those 40 years that Moses was in the court of the Egyptian king, he was also there. And Moses and the man who became Pharaoh during his absence, and was Pharaoh when he returned, that young man was Moses, what shall I say, fellow prince? Yes, fellow prince. And they saw each other, I suppose, every day. Now, as you know, of course, that during those years when Moses was in the land of Egypt, he absolutely refused to become involved in the Egyptian religious services. He remained absolutely faithful to God, and therefore Moses gave a very powerful witness for God while he was there in the court of Pharaoh. So therefore, through Moses, we'll put here the word the prince, and this prince was the prince who was to become the Pharaoh during Moses' absence, and was to be the Pharaoh when Moses returned, the Pharaoh who was to resist God and upon whom fell the 10 plagues of Egypt. Now, as we said a moment ago, during that period of sojourn there in the land of Egypt, God, up in heaven above, through Moses, was exerting upon that prince a very, very powerful saving influence. Now, if that prince had received that message along with the rest of the court, or at least even if by himself he received that message, then what would the gospel have done to his heart? It would have softened it, wouldn't it? But when that prince rejected the ministry of God through Moses, then what happened to him while he was a young man still? His heart was hardened. And when Moses was driven away, of course, into Midian, and during those 40 years, then the hardness which had begun during that period there developed during those 40 years of Moses' absence. And by the time that Moses came back, what kind of Pharaoh was upon the throne? A very obstinate, a very tough, a very hardened Pharaoh. But now, would that Pharaoh have been as hard as he was if he had not received God's ministry through Moses? No, he wouldn't. So therefore, it was God's ministry through Moses who raised up that particular Pharaoh to be as hard and as tough as he was. So then, if we come back to Romans 9th chapter a moment, which says, "For the scripture said unto Pharaoh, even for this same purpose have I raised thee up, that I might show my power in thee, and that my name might be declared throughout all the earth." We made the point in the study of God's character that the determination of deliverance day for the Israelites was fixed not by an arbitrary choice on God's part, but rather by that point of time when the Egyptians had become so apostate that they brought upon themselves the outpouring of God's wrath, which is nature out of God's control and out of man's control as well. And in other words, by the self-destruction process, their power to hold the Israelites had become broken. Now, God was able to accelerate the day of deliverance because of the faithful witness of Moses to that prince back there. That hardened him. That speeded up the day of retribution, the day when the Egyptians would be no longer able to receive immunity or protection from the awful scourges which fell upon them at that point of time. Now, it is in this way that God works in human affairs. He works to save and not to destroy. Let's go a little further now in Romans 9th chapter to get this thought very clear in mind. Where it says, verse 18, "Therefore hath he mercy on whom he will have mercy, and whom he will he hardeneth." Alright then, the mercy of God was extended toward this Pharaoh. At that time he was a prince, of course, in his father's court, later to become Pharaoh in the place of his dead father. Now, God showed mercy toward that prince, but the choice as to whether he would be hardened or softened rested not with God, but with whom? Like with the prince. So God has mercy on those who receive that mercy, but those who are hardened are hardened because they choose to reject that message. Now, Paul anticipated, of course, the fact that many folk would raise the argument, well, then why does God find fault? For who hath resisted his will? The argument is, of course, that if God arbitrarily decides who will be hardened and who will be softened, then how can God punish people in the end for being what God himself has made them? And that's quite a sound argument, if that were so. But Paul says, nay, but, O man. In other words, don't bring up those kind of arguments, because they don't have a foundation in fact. Nay, but O man, who art thou reprised against God, shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why hast thou made me thus? Hath not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel unto honour and another unto dishonour? Now, of course, we have to recognize the fact that the illustration of clay here has a certain inadequacy about it, because while in the case of the clay is the potter's choice as to whether this pot shall be this shape or this one this shape over here, but in the case of handling human clay, we are the ones who make the choice as to how we shall respond to the work of the master potter. And so when God makes the vessel, let's take Nebuchadnezzar for instance, and gives that king tremendous power. Well, when I say God didn't particularly give that king power, but the king was put in the position where he could acquire and gather all that tremendous power to himself. Now, of course, the power which he gathered was intended by God not to destroy and tear down and break up, as Nebuchadnezzar did, but rather it was intended by God for him to use that to be a blessing and a benefit. Just as this great tree was a refuge to all the wild animals and birds and so forth, so Nebuchadnezzar was to be a great protection to the peoples of the entire world and not a selfish and self-seeking monarch. So, in verse 21, we must recognize, of course, that that human clay does have a choice power and therefore is the real factor which determines what kind of vessel we shall be made into. Think too of the fact, of course, that God invests in humanity powers and talents and so forth, and whether that those talents are used to God's honor or dishonor again depends upon the vessel itself. To come back to Daniel the 4th chapter now, and I think we should recognize the fact that it is by God's powers, manipulated by man and not by God himself, that the kings of the earth acquire their positions, fill those positions, and either honor themselves and the God of heaven, or they dishonor themselves and the God of heaven. God does not arbitrarily appoint this man's position or that man's position as the case may be. That is, so far as earthly kings and potentates are concerned. In some cases, of course, God is able to place a man in the position God designs he should fill. But even then, that man does not always honorably fill that position. A case in point is King Saul and King David. God was able to have a say in just which man would occupy the throne in Saul's case and again in David's case. After, of course, it became a matter of sonship on the side of the tribe of Judah and the side of the other ten tribes of Israel, it became a matter of which man had the power to unseat the previous king and thus start a new dynasty. I see my time is about gone, but let's just close with this thought, that God does not arbitrarily put this man in that place and that man in the other place. He gives his powers, placed his powers in this earth for men to use, and by human manipulation of these powers, that this man takes the place or that man takes the place. But because God's powers involved, therefore it says that God does it. He does do it through his powers, but not by his own arbitrary choice. Otherwise, of course, against God some fearful indictments must be levelled for putting certain men in positions that have brought only trouble and sorrow and distress and hardship to mankind. We'll close at that point, and we'll pick up this theme again. We'll resume our studies tomorrow morning at around about 10 o'clock.